Peter Christoph, and it's my pleasure to be able to both introduce the Right Honourable John Gummer, Lord Deben, and to facilitate tonight's or this afternoon's proceedings. Let me begin first of all by, of course, acknowledging the traditional owners of the land that we're meeting on, the Wurundjeri, and their elders, both past and present. I'm sure that most of us who are here because we are puzzled by a number of things, but one first and foremost in the current context, which is the seemingly natural bond between conservative politics and a deep resistance to action on climate change in Australia. And it seems that this has been a long-standing condition in Australia, but it isn't as natural as it seems. And if you have a look at some of the most innovative governments internationally, for example, in Europe, both Germany and the United Kingdom, it's quite striking that over the last 20 years of climate policy, in fact, there's been conservative governments that have driven very progressive climate policy and policy change from almost the outset. So you think of the government of Margaret Thatcher, or in Germany, of Helmut Kohl, as initiators of the sorts of policy trajectories that have left the United Kingdom and also Germany as leaders internationally in terms of emissions mitigation and a whole range of other progressive manoeuvres and shifts and changes which have consequences for us. So there's this puzzle for us in Australia, the natural, seemingly natural association between conservative politics and climate inaction, and the changes that we've seen initiated by conservative politicians and politics overseas leave us with a conundrum. I think there are very few people who could give us a better insight as to into what the changes might be, what the differences might be, than Lord Deben. And I just want to spend a few moments introducing him to you properly, because his background, his political background and his environmental credentials are exceptional under the circumstances, particularly in the context that we face in Australia. John Gummer was elected to the House of Commons in the 1970 general election for the Lewisham West constituency, and he remained elected for one term only. However, in 1979, he was returned to the House of Commons, securing the seat of Eye and then holding the constituency until its abolition in 1983. But from then until his retirement in 2010, he was a Member of Parliament for one of its successor constituencies, the Suffolk Coast. Re-elected in 1979, John Gummer held various positions in government, including serving as Conservative Party Vice Chairman and Chairman in the mid-1980s. In 1989, he joined Margaret Thatcher's cabinet as Minister for Agriculture, Fisheries and Food. Under John Major, in 1993, he was appointed Secretary of State for the Environment, and he remains the longest-serving Secretary of State for the Environment the United Kingdom has ever had. In 2005, David Cameron appointed him Chairman of the Quality of Life Commission, and he continues this work today in the House of Lords. And after 35 years as a Conservative Party Member of Parliament, John Gummer retired in the 2010 general election, and he is only one of only five others in the last 200 years who have held such a long period of office. In June 2010, following his retirement as an MP, he was awarded a peerage and the title of Lord Deben. Lord Deben has had a career-long interest in environmental issues and has consistently championed an identity between environmental concerns and also business. He established and runs Sandscroft, a corporate responsibility consultancy working with blue-chip companies around the world on environmental, social and ethical issues. Since leaving political office, he's been the chairman of the Marine Stewardship Council, the Chairman of the International Commission on Sustainable Consumption, and Non-Executive Director of Kittle. He is currently Chairman of BALPAC, Chairman of the Association of Independent Financial Advisors, and Chairman of a range of other companies as well. His experience as an international negotiator has earned him worldwide respect in both the business community and amongst environmentalists, as well as numerous accolades. As the Environment Secretary, the United Kingdom, from 1993 to 1997, he played a key role in the Convention on Climate Change meetings in Berlin and Geneva. The Secretary General of the United Nations named him one of a small committee of distinguished persons advising on Habitat II, the United Nations Conference on Human Settlements. And in 1996, he was elected Chairman of the Environment Committee of the OECD by his fellow ministers. He was a significant player in the reform of the United Nations Environment Programme and also the Commission on Sustainable Development. And when the Labour Party took office, Lord Deben was included in the United Kingdom's delegation to the special session of the United Nations General Assembly, Earth Summit Plus 5, and subsequently to the Climate Change Conference in Kyoto and Buenos Aires. Friends of the Earth called him the best environmental secretary the UK has ever had. The BBC awarded him their title Parliamentarian Who Did Most for the Environment Internationally in their Green Awards in 95 and 96. In 1997, he was awarded a Medal of Honour by the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, the United Kingdom's largest environment organisation, and is the only government minister ever to have received this award. In 2007, BBC Wildlife magazine described him as the Environment Secretary against which all others are to be judged and put him in their top 10 environmental heroes. In April 2005, Lord Deben joined with a former Environment Secretary from the Labour Party and the Environment Spokesperson from the Liberal Democrats to unveil a draft piece of climate legislation in Parliament. It was this bill that eventually became the UK's landmark 2008 Climate Change Act, an act against which many of us still measure progress internationally. In June 2010, Lord Deben was elected as the President of the International Non-Government Organisation, GLOBE, which brings together parliamentarians all over the world to work on environmental issues and which has six chapters in 16 countries, including India, Korea, Japan, China, Brazil, Germany, France, and throughout the European Union. So it's with these credentials I'd like to welcome Lord Deben to speak to us. He's certainly going to provide us with some insights I'm sure we will be greatly welcoming. Thank you very much.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's a very great pleasure to be here, and thank you for coming. One of those things that happens when you do my kind of job is that people give you particular titles, and the title to speak to, I mean, and the title that you have chosen is for me to start from an almost party political end of talking about the right and climate change. I want really, though, to start by saying that it seems to me that the crucial issue about making decisions of this sort is our attitude towards science. And I want really to start there, because there is a huge problem for politicians about science. And I can say that with more confidence than most, because I was the Minister of Agriculture who had to deal with the mad cow disease issue. And of course, what you discover then is that what the public wants is certainty. What they really want you to be able to say is there is no doubt whatsoever in any circumstances that this is safe. And what they find very difficult is that no scientist will ever say that about anything, because it is of the nature of science that what a scientist is saying is, if I take all the evidence that is available at the moment and properly assess it, this is where I think we are now. But if I am asked, will we be here tomorrow, I have to say, yes, if the evidence doesn't change. And of course, people don't like that. It is too complicated. And politicians can't sloganize on that kind of concept. And they want a kind of infallibility which even the church can't give them. The Pope has been infallible on only four occasions in the last 2,000 years. So it means that most statements, even by the Pope, are temporary and as far as theology leads me to think now. The scientists have never claimed to be infallible at all in the last 2,000 years, unless they weren't proper scientists, and yet the public still has a hunger for certainty. So politicians are working within that kind of concept. And I found it particularly interesting in this country to discover how relatively easy it seems to be for people to say, because the science is not certain, i.e. because no proper scientist will say there is no doubt in the sense that there is no circumstance in which I think this might be changed, because that is the case, I may put forward any silly idea I like and be treated as an equally important player in that discussion. Now, of course, we wouldn't do that in any other circumstance. Yesterday afternoon, I was speaking at the Catholic University in Canberra, and after I'd said what I had to say and I was answering questions, the last questions came from somebody who was a climate denier, who said, As it is not certain, and as all this is based upon models, and as no model matters because you can put anything into a model, I don't believe it. And I think I'm right, and climate isn't changing. And I said to him, well, when you go, if you were ill and you went to a surgeon, wouldn't you first of all make sure that the surgeon had in fact passed his examinations? And wouldn't you make sure, therefore, that he had been peer-reviewed? Of course, I'd chosen the wrong person, because this man said no, he said. He said, when I got cancer, I went to my doctor and I told him what I wanted him to do. This, of course, did have a good effect on the rest of the audience, who recognised, therefore, that they could ignore this man's view on climate. Given, I said to him that I didn't mind him choosing his own health, but he wasn't going to choose mine. The fact of the matter is that most of us take the view that in life as a whole, we accept that nothing is certain in the sense that it will never change. But what we do sensibly is to say, what is the evidence that lies here? And if I take the advice of those most capable of assessing the evidence, where does that lead me, and how should I act on that basis? Now, that is exactly the position that Mrs. Thatcher found herself in. I used to have the privilege of not only working for her as a minister, but also of writing some of her speeches, and that meant one was very close to her, because she used to work very hard on her speeches, and so you would spend days working with her, particularly nights. She never went to bed, and she got up very early, and I've eaten more coronation chicken cooked by her in her little flat than almost anyone else, and all I can say to you is that she didn't let you get away with a half sentence that wasn't absolutely accurate. And if you'd seen her nail the climate scientists to the wall as she cross-examined them as a scientist herself, after all, her first job was working for ICI, she didn't want to believe in climate change, because it's extremely inconvenient to believe in climate change. It demands things of you which you would prefer not to have to deal with. But once she had forced from them the answers, and she had tried against them all the arguments, what happened was that she had then to say, if that is right, and it must be the best knowledge that we have, if that is the case, then I cannot, as a responsible leader, I cannot behave in any different way than seeking to change policy in order to try to avoid the obvious danger and damage which climate change will bring about. And that's why we were the first country, perhaps in the world, major country, to take that general view. Of course, you had a lot of problems on the way. I was the minister responsible for sea defences, and I had, quite independently of her, come to the view that climate change was happening. And every 10 years in Britain, we have a rule, which is that you discuss the parameters under which sea defences are agreed. It's the local authority or the environment agency that applies for the money. But in those days, it was the Ministry of Agriculture that provided the money. And in order that you should do so in an objective way, not distinguishing between the east of England, the west of England, or anything else, we used to have a series of rules about how you measured the need and what you would pay and the rest of it. And these parameters were reviewed every 10 years, and it just happened to be a review time, and in came these civil servants to talk to me about it, and the rather smooth senior civil servant, who might well have played a part in Yes Minister, said, yes Minister, well, we have reviewed this, and I'm happy to tell you that we do not believe that there are any changes which are necessary on the present parameters. We think we can continue these for another decade. And a young man at the back broke in and said, well, that is, Minister, if you don't believe in climate change, or in those days, global warming. If you believe in global warming, then you have to think that we probably need to raise the level of sea defences, because the sea itself is likely to rise in level. Well, he got the death stare, as you can imagine, from the boss man. And the boss man said, oh, yes, he said, that is absolutely true, of course. If you believe in global warming, that is the case. And I said, well, I do believe in global warming, as a matter of fact. So there was a pause. And the senior civil servant said to me, well, Minister, It's a very brave position. So you know you've got it right. I mean, so he said, but, because that's the word that always comes after that. He said, the Treasury won't allow you to do this. So I took the opportunity of talking to the Prime Minister because I was dealing with the speech at the time, so I dropped into the conversation on the telephone. We were talking about something else, and then I dropped into the conversation. I said, Prime Minister, I've got this problem. I would like to take your mind on it, and told her the story. There was a pause at the other end of the phone, and the voice then said, John, there are two people in this government who believe in global warming. One is you, the other is me. We are therefore a majority. Now, as a result, Britain put in a policy on sea defences, which has served us extremely well and has meant that we have been ahead of anyone else. But I don't think it's fair to say that the reason that the right has led the battle against climate change is just because of Mrs. Thatcher and science. I think it's one of those issues which historically is part and parcel of a particular way of looking at life. If you go back into the 19th century, for example, it was the right, it was Disraeli, that first started to clean up the rivers and was concerned about clean water. And it is arguable that the public, the acts of clean water acts were the most important social improvements of the time. And remember, cleaning up the water against cholera was in fact a scientific decision. They discovered by science, i.e. observation and measurement, that the reason cholera was spreading was because the access point for water was below the access point, the ejection point for sewage. And that those water companies that took the water from above where the sewage went in had a much lower incidence, if no incidence at all, of cholera. It was a scientific... John Snow actually did produce a scientific answer, and it was that answer upon which Disraeli acted. And then if you think after the Second World War, there was a Labour government until 1951, there was a Conservative government that came in. It was determined to sweep away the rationing and the controls which the Labour Party had put into operation. And in those days, of course, the Labour Party defended rationing. I mean, I was about 10 at the time, and I can remember they would argue that rationing enabled the government to make sure that everybody had a balanced diet. They would argue that. So there wasn't there was really an argument about control at that point. And yet that was the government that introduced the Clean Air Acts, which banned people from burning coal in their own grates. The Englishman's home was not his castle. He wasn't allowed to burn coal for the first time in history. And that's why those great thick fogs, which are so much part of Dickensian history, which would have been crucially important in most of Arthur Conan Doyle's stories, that's why we got rid of them. And I remember it changing. We hated it as children. We disliked those rules very much because it meant that the 5 or 6 days we got off from school because it was too foggy to go to school suddenly wasn't as foggy anymore. And that's what was a Conservative government made those changes. If you look at much later, the Wildlife and Countryside Bill was a Conservative bill. The protections that we have in large measure, not entirely, of course, there were others, the Town and Country Planning Act and the National Parks Act were both Labour measures. I'm not saying it's universal, but in general, it has been true in Britain that the environmental decisions have come from the right. And even in the United States, with whom I have little sympathy on these issues, but even in the United States, if you look back into history, it's been the Republicans that made the great decisions of national parks and the right and the rest. Now, I'm not arguing, therefore, that there is a simple or indeed a unique relationship between right of centre politics and the environment. I'm merely saying that the facts say that there isn't a natural opposition. There isn't something here which makes being sensible about climate change odd. It is part of a tradition. And I think it is discernible also as part of a very fundamental stream of right of centre thinking. At the heart of what I would call sensible conservatism, by which I mean my view of conservatism, at the heart of sensible conservatism is the idea that a stable society is absolutely vital for the good of all. That the people who suffer most from instability in society are the poorest and the most vulnerable. And that therefore you want to create the circumstances in which a society is stable. That's why we talk about things like the property-owning democracy. It was part of that stability. What the great conservative thinker, Sir Keith Joseph, meant when he used a particularly nasty phrase, but it's a good phrase in the sense that it says precisely what he meant. He said, what we look for is the en-bourgeoisification of the whole of society. And I know what he meant by that. Well, I think you know what he meant by that. It meant giving everybody a stake in society, because then there is a degree of stability. And on top of stability is the concept of continuity. One of the reasons why conservatives are concerned about handing on to their children something better than they received themselves is part of that concept of continuity. Now, I'm not arguing with you as to whether this should be or should not be. I'm merely saying it is factually one of those streams of conservative thought which, of course, plays very strongly into this whole issue of the environment, and also particularly into the issue of climate change. Because the one thing that a conservative is very concerned not to have is violent change. This is about evolution and not revolution. It's about continuity rather than the dangerous jerkiness of the interruption of invasion or revolution. And indeed, one of the things that Britain has been so lucky about over the last 1,000 years is something that we constantly come about in our negotiations and discussions in the European Union. Only because we now do that together in such a remarkable way that we've begun to understand just how different we are in one regard. We are the only country in Europe whose constitution has, almost without exception, evolved. 1787 have had five republics and four monarchies. It's been a constant stop, start, stop, start. Now that is contrary to the concept of the conservative. And so it isn't surprising that climate change as an idea is a very frightening one, even in addition to normal fear, for someone who cares about continuity. So my first thesis is very simple, and that is that there is nothing inimical between centre-right politics and a battle against climate change. But the reverse is also true, and that is that it is something very peculiar about a centre-right party that doesn't think that climate change is important. It is aberrant, unusual, not the normal run of things if a party doesn't understand how important that decision is and still claims to be a conservative party. So I think, without making any comments about anybody's particular views or anybody's particular policies, I merely say this makes any party which says it's on the right outside the normal run of things. Because if you look round the European Union, who are the people who are today, not in the past, as my kind introducer said, but who are today fighting? It's President Sarkozy in France. Not a man I always agree with, but there we are, a policy on climate change, which is very radical indeed. It is Angela Merkel, the former, my opposite number, a personal friend as a result, but Angela Merkel, who was my opposite number in Germany as the environment minister. She, a stalwart, fighter for very tough measures indeed on climate change. So we have to recognise those two parts of the thesis, that the normality for right-wing parties is to recognise, first of all, that you take the science, and secondly, that you take the precautionary principle, that you behave in a way which befits parties that really care about continuity and want to ensure stability. So why is it that these parties have become so very strong in dealing with this matter? And I think we have first to accept that we are fortunate in Europe that it is a bipartisan situation. Historically, it wasn't so because, and this is a clue to the situation in Australia, some of the socialist parties and Labour parties in Europe were still very tightly allied to smokestack politics. They had this view, which is a Marxist view, that making things is somehow or other better than service industries, that they were determined in local government, you discover, they would always zone areas for industrial development, even where there was no hope whatsoever of any industrial development at all, but they felt that they ought to, because there was a kind of moral issue about that. So there was a time in which it was quite difficult to convince that solid centre, moderate Labour activists of the issues of climate change. That has changed. And so President Sarkozy and Angela Merkel and David Cameron have in fact the total support of their socialist oppositions in the very tough measures that are being taken. Now, this isn't true through the whole of Europe, of course. Most of it is like that. I can't really speak for Mr. Berlusconi. In fact, no one can speak for Mr. Berlusconi, but the situation in some countries is more complex and more difficult. But then that isn't just about climate change. It's about a whole range of other things as well. So we are, therefore, in a situation in the European Union where left and right, all the serious political parties, have committed themselves to a target which is of an 80% reduction in emissions by 2050. That's 80% on 1990 emissions. And Britain has committed itself, along with some of its neighbours, to a 30% reduction by 2020. And the rest of Europe has committed itself by 20% for that. And we are at the moment having a big battle to see if we can have a figure of 25%. Britain will not reduce its figure, but the others we hope will come up to 25%, which is actually, in our view, the minimum to make the 80% reduction in 2050 credible. It's also important because, as a politician, I know perfectly well that I'm prepared to promise anything for 2050, because I ain't going to be here. But 2020, I do hope to be here, and I therefore think that this is a much more important date to put there, because it forces you to do things now, and you can't leave them for the future. And I do think we have to recognise that although it is more clear in the European Union, although it was true that the European Union led the charge in Kyoto, and has to a great extent led the charge elsewhere, and since then, it isn't only there. I'm the president of GLOBE, as my kind introduction suggested. I gave the prize for the contribution that was the greatest contribution to the battle against climate change and conservation and the environment this year to the president of Korea. Korea has now committed itself to become a carbon-neutral nation, to be the second one after the Vatican. The Vatican is almost there. I just mentioned that. Anybody seeing Cardinal Pell might remind him of that fact. So moving across, that this is a remarkable decision. One of the things I do in my business life is to work with Tesco's, and Tesco's have got a lot of stores in Korea, and no doubt they will feel that they have to join in this movement, because this is going to be a national effort to achieve these ends. And if you look at what's happening in China, again, Globe is working with very senior people in China to help them produce their Climate Change Act. China is going to become, within the next couple of years, the biggest producer of energy from offshore wind, the biggest producer of energy from onshore wind, the biggest producer of energy from photovoltaics in the world. And when I hear Australians saying China isn't doing anything, look, it's building coal-fired power stations, I want to remind them that they are building fewer coal-fired power stations than they would ever have done because of this huge investment in renewables. Secondly, that their coal-fired power stations are significantly cleaner than those in Australia. And thirdly, they are spending vast sums of money on trying to get carbon capture and storage, because they know that that is the one way in which you will be able in the future to be able to deal with coal sensibly. So all that is happening in China. And so the idea that somehow or other the only people who are being asked to do anything are the Australians, which is something that several people have put to me, is just not true. And I do ask myself and wonder why it is that this story has got out, that somehow or other this is the case. And of course it is arguable that with 1.7% of the world's emissions, Australia would make a big deal of difference if it had reduced those emissions significantly. I take the view that that is an argument anybody can have. Britain doesn't have much more emissions than that, certainly less than 3%, however you measure it, probably under 2%, but it's difficult to do the measurement for various reasons about how you do it, and I'll come back to that in a moment. But we could quite easily say any emission reductions that we've done every year have been taken up by other people, so why should we bother to do it? We've set our face against that on the basis that if we said that, then so should everybody else. Who is ever going to do what we suggest we ought to do unless we're doing it ourselves? And the second reason we've done it is, very seriously, you here, all of you, are changing my climate. That's the fact. I'm changing yours too. And we just have to recognise that this is something which we all have to do together, because we all of us have that effect. And that's one of the biggest lessons we have to learn. I always remember ludicrous position of that well-known advanced nation, very intelligent, very good on climate change generally, Denmark. Denmark announced with a flourish that it was closing the last of its fossil fuel generating power plants. And 6 months later, the Overseas Development Agency of Denmark announced with a huge flourish that it had given India what? A fossil fuel generating plant, the very one it had closed, and didn't seem to realise that it doesn't matter where the emissions come, it is a question of the totality of that. And we all of us have to recognise that on this occasion, the huge, exciting fact is that emissions are universal and the climate has changed universally, and therefore we cannot avoid it by saying we're so small we don't matter. And anyway, you can't avoid it because you're not all that small. Because if you measure the emissions by what you actually cause, then you have to add to that the emissions which at the moment are credited to other people. If you are the largest coal exporter in the world, it's very difficult to claim that you don't have much effect on the emissions in the world as a whole. Similarly, you are a big importer, as Britain is, and we have had to say to British people, look, we have actually to take responsibility for a very large amount of the emissions which come from things we import. Otherwise, we get ourselves into this peculiar position of exporting manufacturing to China and then blaming the Chinese for increasing their emissions when actually they are our emissions sent to them. And there is a third reason too. And in this I want to come on to a crucial area which is going to be a very big one, I think, for many of the right-wing parties, because we're moving into an area which right-wing parties have not had to think about before, or indeed no parties have had to think before. If you remember that our emissions affect everyone else and accept that we have a lot of indirect emissions which we have to take, if this is the right word, credit for, we also have to remember that we have two other things. We have, first of all, historic emissions. One of the reasons that Britain has to take responsibility for all this is that we did create, in many ways, the Industrial Revolution. And therefore, much of the climate change we've got today is directly Britain's fault, because we were the great leaders of the Industrial Revolution. And I think we have to take responsibility for that. And we also, because I believe in Chesterton's concept of the continuity of man, we also have to think about the future. You're a country which has every intention of increasing the emissions of the whole world year in, year out, because that is the basis upon which your future depends. That's what you see as the future. I'm not blaming you. I'm merely saying, don't think your emissions are like that, when the whole basis of your future prosperity is about future emissions, just as we have to say that the whole basis of our past prosperity was on past emissions. So to suggest that it's all a matter of the spot check of today is a falsehood. But it's also a falsehood because it avoids the third and just as important issue. We all live as a result of our pollution at a level which is significantly higher than that of most of the population of the world. And what is happening in this world is that more and more, because of trade, because of globalization, more and more people are beginning to move into a position in which they are able to make choices, moving from subsistence to middle-class situations. There are more middle-class people in India than there are in the whole of Europe already. In China, if every Chinese person drinks a half pint of lager a year more, the world's grain harvests are in real danger, and the world's barley harvest would not be enough to meet the needs. We are living in a world in which the pressures of population towards 9 billion in the year 2050, and more importantly than that, the pressures of world populations which are beginning to be able to make choices, are changing the situation dramatically. And one of the things that people who are climate change deniers have to answer, and they never do, is we're going to have to do this anyway, because there will not be the resources in the world to feed, clothe, and shelter the vast increase in numbers and demands and expectation of numbers over the years that come. We are in the thin years after the Thatchers. I always believe very strongly in that biblical concept. The seven Thatchers are followed by the seven thin years. The only things we don't know is how many years it is, how much a year is. But we are certainly now in the thin years. And if you look at the revolutions that are happening in North Africa in particular and elsewhere in the Arab world, don't be kidded. Of course, these are nasty regimes who have deserved revolutions for a long time. But why have they chosen now? It's because of food prices. It's because in each of these countries there has been both food price rises of a gigantic kind and food shortage. And as one of my colleagues in the House of Lords said the other day, I think in a most memorable phrase, he said, every government has to recognise that it's only 9 meals away from revolution. And that is the key to the second part of what we have to talk about. And that is that we're living in a world where the pressures on resources are going to grow ineluctably. Now, that doesn't mean to say I take a kind of Club of Rome view about finite resources and the rest. We constantly find new things, shale gas and ways of using uranium, all sorts of concepts of fusion, and we can do all kinds of things that we didn't know we could do. So I'm not suggesting that it's a simple matter. I'm merely suggesting that we are not going easily to be able to meet the requirements of the world where everyone will expect much higher standards, when there will be more people. We're not going to be able to do that if we become, if we refuse to accept that wastage is just not going to be on the cards. We've actually got to recognise that keeping our resources, using them efficiently and effectively, recognising that this world is a finite world in that sense, is going to be a part of any sensible and prudential view of the future. Now, of course, that's going to be a tough time and tough thing for right-wing parties. And I want to suggest there are some things there which are important for us particularly. If we're going to use those resources properly, then a competitive economy is very important. You can't afford the kind of wastage which a command and control economy produces. But a competitive economy demands that there is indeed a proper market. And one of the problems with right-wing parties is always that they seem to suggest that a market is a proper market because it is. In other words, that any market that is seen not to be controlled by the government is in fact a proper market, whereas that isn't true. An awful lot of markets are very constrained. In this country, you spend £1.5 billion subsidising the diesel that is used in the mining industry. That doesn't mean the mining industry is a proper market. You are distorting the market by £1.5 million. And when politicians say we don't want any more taxes, I would suggest that this is a tax that you can get rid of, because you are taking £1.5 million out of the pockets of Australians in order to put the money into the pockets of people who are already earning super profits. On any grounds, in any way, why are we doing this? And the reason we were doing it, we can go back and find out why we were doing it, but today what it's doing is distorting the market. And we do it in Britain, we do it all around the world. For a long time, the Germans distorted the market by making it very cheap to use brown coal. That was the East German way. In Britain, we have a number of extremely peculiar arrangements about capital and about the credit that you get for capital, which distorts the market significantly. And so one of the things we've got to learn is that we need to be very tough about markets. And that is very important for the right, because we should be able to have our eyes open to the realities of capitalism. I once had a conversation with the present leader of the Labour Party in Britain, who is a very nice man and was the Minister for the Environment and Climate Change. And I'm afraid I got to the point of listening to him that I did say to him, look, you have to understand that you have all the drawbacks of a convert. And I said, what's more, I can tell you about the drawbacks of the convert, because I am a convert Catholic. And therefore I know the danger of being a convert, and that is that you think that that to which you have been converted is much more perfect than it really is. Cradle Catholics are much better at judging these things. I said, cradle capitalists are in the same position. We cradle capitalists know about capitalism, and we know about businessmen. I've been a businessman all my life, and I know that there are two things I like. One is no monopolies for anyone else. and the other is monopolies for me. And if I can organise it so that I am a monopoly and I get the advantages of everybody else having to compete for all the things that I buy, that is ideal. And if you are a convert, you don't really realise that. And you don't realise that when you ask me, can you bear this kind of regulation, or that kind of tax, or this sort of levy, or that sort of incentive, I will always say, no, not as much as that. I might be able to do that much. Whereas if you are, in fact, on the right and a business party, you ought to be in the position of knowing that you can get business to do anything this side of the impossible. And you should be constantly asking of business something which is just this side of the impossible. And it's your duty to do so. Because what business then does is to operate the market to find ways of avoiding the costs. So what they do is to innovate. That is where innovation comes. Some of the biggest, most important changes of innovation in Britain that are happening now are because of our climate change regulation. It's because we forced people to think differently. It's because they now can't do these things easily and they have to break through. And that's why we've had to use all the mechanisms. And this is not the right moment to go through those, except to say that we have a trading scheme. We put it in on a very low level to start with. We've cranked it up. Next year it'll go up, European trading scheme. Next year it'll go up even more sharply. We have taxation, which is direct. It's not as effective as we'd like to do it, so we're going to change it to a carbon tax. That is part of the Conservative Party election manifesto, and we shall deliver that. We have a system whereby there is an obligation laid upon electricity companies to produce a given proportion, a rising proportion of their generating capacity from renewables, and therefore what they actually do is to put a levy on all electricity sales and use that money, and the government ensures that it's paid out in a sensible way so that some kinds of renewables get more than other kinds. And we have a system too where we are encouraging people by enabling them to have loans by the electricity companies again to improve their insulation, to put in modern boilers, to reduce their energy demand, and thereby to pay it back from the savings that they make. And that is, of course, securitized against the house, and it means we've got a whole new area in which we can take that money in. Isn't tax? There are many pension funds who are very happy to get a securitized return, a very low securitized return, an utterly safe investment for people who want that to continue over many years. So we're doing all those things. But I want to end with the big challenge. And it's a challenge which means that I believe that we are living in the most exciting moment of life for the last 500 years. I started thinking about the world in which we live and recognising that there is a huge change. Climate change really does make a very big difference in the way we look at the rest of the world. But it is not the only thing that does. It is part of a series of other things. Globalisation, the shortage of resources, the question of food security and fuel security, the change in the economic position of the majority of poor people, all those things have a real impact. And in case you don't think that, just imagine what would happen if the television showed night after night millions of people without food. No government could fail to do something about it. There is a sense in which there are global demands today which modern communications make absolute and effective in a way in which when the message came from India and it took 3 months, nobody bothered. It was passed. You couldn't. Were they still starving? I don't know. 3 months ago they were. Well, perhaps they're all right now. But see it on the television tonight, then of course, you can't allow it, ultimately. That, of course, is the problem with climate change. I want to say to Americans, for example, when they say it's nothing to do with us, we'll be all right. Yes, But if you have 170 million Bangladeshis no longer able to live in a country which is underwater, wandering around the world looking for a home, you're in the area of the great mass migrations of Huns and Vandals and the rest. You're in a different world. And no government is going to be able to deal with stability unless you deal with that. And if Tories, Conservatives, Liberals, Country Party, National, if we are going to face this world, then stability demands that we do have to relearn the need for a degree, a much bigger degree of social justice. Because there is no way in which you can get the rest of the world, the poor countries, to join in with this battle against climate change if it is on the basis that the rich nations retain their riches and the poor nations make up with the bit that's left over. This is only going to work if we recognise that we have to find a way through clean technology exchange, through having a different way of looking at the way in which the globalisation system works, looking much more clearly at how we can run a world which is in the interests of us all. It's only by that that we can expect Malaysia and others to join. And therefore, that is a real challenge for us, because it does challenge that fundamental offering which the right of centre has, which is of stability. A stable world is just as necessary in a global economy as a stable nation. It is more difficult to say that or to explain it, because there's always been a connection between the nation and the right, which is at its best patriotism and at its worst nationalism, but that connection has got to be extended, which is why I fight so hard against those in my party who don't understand that membership of the European Union is not only necessary but a triumph, an amazingly wonderful thing, the most important thing that has happened in Europe since the war and probably for the last 200 years. Because what it is people trying who live next door to each other trying to live together. And we're finding it pretty difficult. We've got to live with the French. It's not easy. I tell you, it isn't. But if we can't live with the French, how the blazes are we supposed to live with the Malaysians? I mean, we share religion, we share culture, we share history, we share very many things with the French, including a hearty dislike of each other, but we share all those things. We don't share anything like as much with the Malaysians, and yet we are finding it difficult to live with the French. And this is why it is a real challenge for us, because in this world, this is the new world. We have to live in the world as a globe in a real sense. That brings me to the very last coda to this last point. I said I think it's the most exciting time to live since the Renaissance. And the reason is that we have to look at our neighbours in a wholly different way. It's the first time in history that we cannot be imperialist. Iraq was, in my view, the last imperial war. That's why I voted against it. It was wrong, it was illegal, it was immoral, and it was stupid. And it was stupid because it was a country, America, thinking that you could behave today with today's communications as you used to behave. And the truth is, you can't do that anymore. There's not a question of whether you should or you shouldn't. It's a question of you can't. WikiLeaks is only part of the same pattern. We live in a world where transparency is absolute, and where the under-25s in particular, and anybody here who's under 25 is of what I call the engines, the internet generation. You've grown up with something. It's part of your life in a way it isn't for us, even those of us who are reasonably literate in this. It's not part of our lives as it is to you. And therefore, different attitudes. The internet has changed people's attitudes. And of course, it's made it much more important and possible for people to know what's going on, to link together, to do all kinds of things they could never do before. And all this is about knowledge. And that's why I want this coda. It's about knowledge. I come back to where I started, this huge problem of trying to communicate science, which seems particularly difficult here in Australia, but is true throughout the world. And I had a real mind-changing experience, because while I was doing some detailed work on climate change, my oldest son was writing a book, just finishing it, the standard book, on the Black Death. And as I was reading about climate change and trying to work some of these things out, I was also reading chapter after chapter as they came off finally from the computer. And what struck me was the fundamental difference. These are both huge challenges to human life as we know it today and as they knew it at that time. Real challenges. But with the Black Death, nobody knew what was happening. Indeed, they did exactly the wrong thing. They went on pilgrimages and crowded into churches and gave it to each other because they didn't know what was happening. The point about climate change is that we do know, and that knowledge changes everything. And I think this is, for me, the Genesis moment. Because the reality of that, the most ancient myth in the Bible, it is a myth which is utterly true. And that is that once you know, you have to leave the garden. You're not the same any longer. You become responsible in a very different way. And what is happening among the climate deniers is that they don't want to know, because they deep down understand that if they did know, then they would have to act. And George W. Bush is the prize example, because he knew that once he admitted climate change, the whole of his American foreign policy, the whole of his attitude towards society, everything that he stood for was now going to be challenged. Because, of course, he comes of a different historical stream. Not the conservative right-of-centre stream, but a different kind of thing, which is wrongly called neoconservatism. It's neither neo nor conservative. It is old-fashioned laissez-faire liberalism. And that has no place in a world which knows. We know, and therefore we have to act. And what the right has to learn is that it's at the heart of its contribution to the world that when it knows, it acts, and it doesn't hide from the science, it doesn't hide from the truth, but it accepts it on the chin and seeks to do what it has a duty to do if it is to protect the stability not only of its own country, but of the world.
While you're gathering your thoughts, I think some of you may be thinking that Lord Deben actually is masquerading as a conservative. Others of you are trying to work out where in the spectrum of political intellectual life in Australia you would fit in. Some of you may be wondering whether you need to emigrate to the United Kingdom at this point in time. Lord Deben has very kindly agreed to take questions for about the next half an hour, and if you could ask, if the questions could come through me, if they could be brief and to the point, that would be terrific. Yes.
Lord Deben, thank you very much. It was, you know, clearly radical, methy, brilliant, Australian conservative. No, it's truly wonderful and very refreshing to have an esteemed conservative voice speaking up on common sense. In your analysis, and I know you've only been there a short time, do you think the situation amongst conservatives in Australia is irretrievable? And if it's not, what is the left's role in bringing conservatives to a common sense position?
Well, first of all, I've met some extremely sensible conservatives who are very clearly of the same opinion, and if they were here today, would have accepted everything I said. And some of them are very senior members of the Liberal. So I don't get miserable about it. People are convincible. We are right, the truth and the facts are with us, and therefore it will be okay. It's just flipping nuisance at the moment. My own view is that it will gradually dawn on people that they live in a world and that other people are doing all these things, and that the Australian economy depends upon at least getting themselves into a position in which they are congruent with what is happening in the rest of the world. Business people will begin to press, as they are already privately, although one of the things that's odd about Australia is that business people in general don't speak out in the way we're lucky to have them in Europe, where the heads of great companies are very strongly pressing for climate change legislation. And even in the United States, where you can have people like the chairman of GE or the chairman of Coca-Cola, a whole range of people who come out and make it quite clear that this really needs to be part of the programme of the business party. In fact, the Republicans aren't listening to them at the moment, I think is a matter of regret, but it will happen in the end. So let's get the businessmen, and they will in fact increasingly be saying to Australian governments, look, we must have certainty on this. We must have. There's nothing worse than certainty. We'd prefer to have a bad piece of legislation where we know where we are, but let's get that. So I think that will happen. The third thing that will happen, I think, is that that events, remember the great comment of that wonderful Conservative Harold Miller, when asked about what changes Conservative policy, he said, events, dear boy, events. And I think that's what will happen. Events, i.e. Things will happen, and they will have to come to terms with new situations. And in coming to terms with that, they'll have to recover. So it seems to me that it's a toxic issue at the moment. It's necessary to move to a position in which changes are made, and then I think the decisions will be different. And one of the things that will happen is that people will look closely at the alternatives that are presented to them. And as somebody from outside, I have no intention of saying which I think is the better or indeed what the problems with them are. But it must be that sensible people apply to what the opposition is proposing and what the government is proposing those three fundamental questions. The first is, will it work? The second is it cost-effective? I'm a Tory. I don't want to spend any more money on this than I need to, but is it cost-effective? And the third thing is it enough? And as voters begin to ask those questions, I think they will begin to recognise that actually the solutions on offer at the moment may lack answers to those three. And that may mean changes, or it may mean also that people begin to realise that this is a more complex thing, that simple solutions, and I'm afraid that's what both sides are offering at the moment, are not enough. I gave a quick rundown of what we're doing in Europe. There's no simple answer. There's no golden rule. There's no silver bullet. We have to do a whole range of things which involve people, because then individuals have got to do it, and which involve local authorities or states, which involve governments, which involve the international community, which are about tax, which are about changes in our regulations and in our subsidies, and which are about to innovation and encouragement. So I think that's another thing that will happen.
You mentioned, you spoke about how in the UK you achieved a multi-party consensus in bringing important legislation about, a situation which seems almost miraculous to us here. Were there specific barriers that had to be overcome to achieve that, and if so, how did you do it?
Well, as in so many cases, there's a good deal of good fortune in this. I mean, what happened was that the Conservative Party had a new leader who believed in all this. It also had a shadow environment secretary who was very creative and very close to the non-governmental organisations. And they cooked up between them the idea of the Climate Change Committee and the independence outside of targets and budgets for sectors of industry. And they did so at a time in which people were particularly questioning about the integrity of government and the like. And therefore the idea of that independence was extremely attractive. And they managed to get on side the whole of the opposition. And they got enough members of the Labour Party to say that they would vote against the whip to force the government to take on board this proposal. Now, there were several hiccups on the way, one of which I will tell you about, which was trying to get the Democratic Unionist Party on side. I mean, we had the Scottish Nationalists and the Welsh Nationalists, but we didn't have the Irish National, well, the Irish Protestant Party, led by Mr. Ian Paisley, for whom science is not a notable part of his views. And Mr. Paisley's party, we had to have online, because we really did have to have every vote. It was terribly important to say to the Labour Party there was nobody in the entire Parliament, apart from the Labour Party, who didn't want this bill. And so we got a letter, which was carefully phrased with all this in it, and sent it round, and everybody was happy to sign it, until I and others got a message from the Reverend William Beattie, who was a Protestant minister from Northern Ireland. And he said, I cannot sign this letter. So we said, well, why not? It's what we agreed. Well, he said, it's this bit here. And we decided that it was important to put in the letter some of the science. And so we had put in the bit about if you go down into the ice cap and you go back all these hundreds of thousands of years and see that this is the point at which warming has risen faster and further than ever before. And he said, that's against God's law. We've only been here for 80,000 years, not 400,000 years, and I cannot sign up. It's against the Bible. If you add the dates in the Bible up, we've only been here 82,000 years. So we just put in the sentence, for a very long time. So there was a certain amount of problem on the way, but we ended up. We ended up with an agreement, and then the Treasury tried to stop it. Gordon Brown, as one would expect, was totally opposed to it. But the Climate Change and Energy Minister put it to the Cabinet that he wasn't going to win. And it was better to make it a government act when they could perhaps soften it a bit. So they got it as a government act, and then all we did was to make it worse. They put the act forward, and it was going to be 60% reduction by 2050. And we got it up to 80. We did all the things that were necessary. So it is a very, very tough thing. I mean, this Climate Change Committee can take the government to court if it doesn't meet the targets. And the courts are bound then to insist that the government take the measures that will reach the target. So that's how we did it. It was the right moment, the right time, and some pretty determined people.
I wonder if you could give a seasoned politician's view on a suggestion. As you know, at the moment in Australia, there's a very bitter debate about the introduction of carbon tax. Mm. And there's been some semantic debate about whether it really is a tax. What the Labor government hasn't done is call this tax a dumping fee, which they could have. They're charging for the right for, you know, big polluters to dump their pollution into the atmosphere. That would be to reframe the issue as to whether we should have a user pays dumping fee as opposed to a tax. Now, if that strategy hasn't been adopted, why not?
Well, I mean, it's not for me to say why it hasn't been adopted, and it has not. I even if I did know, I wouldn't say it, because it seems to me the last thing you want is somebody from Britain to come and tell you how to do things. But I do think it does illustrate one of the things I was saying was just about the market. I mean, the point is this, that the market does not include all these costs. And the way I look at it is that I want the market to include the costs. Now, when you go to Britain and you arrive in Heathrow and you drive in to London, you look on the right-hand side, there are some very pretty, suddenly, a whole area of leisure spots where people sit and the grass looks lovely and the rest of it. Now, that was a dump, and it was a Victorian rubbish dump. And what happened in the Victorian days was people made money, partly because they didn't pay the cost of getting rid of the rubbish that they left. And it's in our generation that we've had to get rid of that rubbish, we've had to recover that area, and we're paying that cost. It ought to have been part of the charge they made for the goods that they produce. And that's where I think we have to do this argument. We have to say products and producers have a responsibility to pay the full cost. Otherwise, there is no proper market decision. And that's why in the European Union we have a producer responsibility system. So if you put packaging on the marketplace, you have to pay for its recycling. And we jack that up every year. If you put batteries on the marketplace, you have to pay for their recollection and recycling. If you put electronic or electrical equipment on the marketplace, you have to pay for its recycling and its reuse. Now, it hasn't destroyed our economies. It simply says that the price has got to include the real cost. It is a market instrument. And the people who do best out of it are the businesses who manage, therefore, to start to produce goods which need less recycling or can be recycled more easily or actually use less resource in the first place. It's had a huge effect on the reduction of packaging because people don't want to pay. And lightweighting is now a universal activity so that you don't use as much plastic or you don't use as much glass. All that has happened because we have internalized the real cost. And one of the things I think we've got to learn is that there is a real cost of pollution which primary industries actually have to contribute to. And so does everybody else in the chain. In the packaging, it's not only the people who make the packaging, the people who put things into a box, people who make the cardboard, people who put things in the box, the people who then wholesale it, the people who then retail it. Everybody pays towards this because everybody is benefiting out of that packaging. And we have a system which works extremely well in the marketplace. We have a marketplace system. And as a writer, a right-wing person, I want just to make that point, that in Britain, our system for recycling packaging costs £180 million a year. In Germany, it costs £1.8 billion, 10 times as much, because we have a competitive system and they have a state-run system, or it was a state-run system, it's now a monopolistic system. So let's get the very best mechanisms in order to do this. And you're quite right, we ought to be talking about internalising these things. But I think we're too far down the road on that particular issue probably to reformulate it.
Do you think it would help if we had more scientists in power?
Well, I think, and now I'm going to be rude to half the audience, I think there's a huge problem. Far too many people in the world aren't numerate, but far too many numerate people aren't literate. That there's a real difficulty. Actually, scientists are very bad at communicating these things because they constantly feel that because of their ethics, they have constantly to say, this is the best I can do. This is the sort that I'm with this kind of caveat and that kind of caveat. And they hate getting to the position in which they have to be certain enough for them to be taken seriously. So I think that's a difficulty. The other difficulty is that they very often can't explain what they're saying in language which ordinary people can understand. And they tend to blame the ordinary people for that. They tend to say, well, if only we had better science education, then people would understand it. And I want to say to them, I'm afraid you've got to learn, as politicians and as priests, and everyone else who's got something important to say has got to learn, I hope not sloganising, but has got to learn a way of keeping people interested enough to listen to you for long enough to get the message over in language they understand. That's why I didn't have on this thing here any of those awful aids, as they call it, the PowerPoint, because it does seem to me that you've got to engage people sufficiently for them to be prepared to listen to the whole argument, and I'm afraid many scientists speak in a way which turn you off very early on because they think you understand some very fundamental things which you don't. Most people don't. I, for example, have had to learn all my science as an adult, because I never learnt it at school. And therefore I'm actually more up to date than most because I knew I knew nothing, so I started from the beginning again. But I really make the point that it isn't that. That isn't the problem. The problem is that too many politicians are not prepared to recognise that they have a fundamental responsibility which goes beyond the moment, which is about the future. And I always want to say to them, I have to go round the world doing my best on climate change because I do not want, I haven't got any grandchildren at the moment, but I've got four children. I do not want my grandchildren to come to me and say, Daddy, Granddaddy, what did you do? And it seems to me that is the question. It's the same question that you might have asked German politicians in 1933, because it's just as frightening. We have got to make sure that the world doesn't accept an attitude to its future which is destructive. And therefore, we have to say to every politician, I don't want to hear about the electoral advantages one way or the other. I want to know, how are you going to answer your grandson in 20 years' time when he knows that the cost to him because you didn't act is so overwhelming that his whole future is threatened? And that is actually the question which will be asked. And I just hope some of these people are alive to hear it. Or better still, I hope that they will learn quickly enough for that question not to have to be asked.
I think that's a wonderful note to end on. That's all right with everyone. Let me just conclude by giving three small lots of thanks. Firstly, thanks to the Melbourne Sustainable Societies Institute for actually sponsoring and putting together this meeting. Secondly, I think I'd like to thank all of you for firstly having the endurance and the capacity to sit through a very complex, very challenging and very powerful set of arguments, and for the very fine questions that you've put. But of course, most of all, I want to thank Lord Deben for that very powerful message that he's given us. The challenge, partly to reframe the ways in which we think about conservative politics, but most importantly, the ways in which we think about our own role in tackling climate change. And if you can join me in thanking him for a very powerful speech.